It turns out that I failed to instruct the people who were assigning classrooms that I wanted a classroom with video recording. So we don't have video recording, and I am currently doing audio recording on my cell phone, which is a very nice audio recorder. And I will be posting that up on the webpage for people who want to review things. But my guess is there's nothing to be done at this point to get us video to last. Are there any questions on the mechanics of the course, the stuff I discussed before about what's supposed to be done when and what your obligations are and stuff? Yes?
So I wasn't here for the first class. Should I consider the syllabus as a sufficient source of class mechanics information?
I think so. The information on the webpage, the syllabus is one of several things linked to the webpage. And altogether, I think the webpage says everything, and most of it's probably true. All right. Yes.
Okay, so the reading. I saw the reading online, and I saw that some of it was in your book. And there was, like, chapter 2, Gypsies, page...
That's right. The book on gypsies was... It's on reserve in the library, but it also should be in the bookstore because I gave it to them on the list of books for the course.
Oh.
Book is called Gypsy Law.
Okay. And
it's got a fair amount of interesting stuff. And I don't think the editor is very good, but he didn't write the chapters, and the chapters are good.
Okay.
The editor is too worried about people being prejudiced against the gypsies and not interested enough in what trying to actually understand the system. But the chapters are great.
See it when I was in the bookstore.
Yeah. Well, I haven't checked the bookstore. They may not have it. All I know is that I told them to have it.
Okay.
The map doesn't always map to match the territory. Other questions on mechanics? No. All right. There should also be a couple of copies on reserve if you can't get a printed copy. A number of things with regard to the papers. The first is if you have more than one clever idea for a paper, tell me the extra ones and I'll put them on the webpage so other people can use them. I believe in giving away ideas whenever you have no use for them. One of the more popular pages on my website is a page of ideas for short stories that I'm not going to write. And I've had a number of people write them, and the fun thing was when people wrote the story and took it in a direction that had not occurred to me. And so then I web the stories if I have permission of the authors. So sort of one part of the open source approach to doing stuff that the web makes very easy. Other points with regard to the papers, one of them is this course is on legal systems very different from ours. So I am not interested in a paper on modern Canadian law or modern Japanese law. A modern system that really is not connected with sort of the mainline set of legal systems that we normally study is fine. And if you're doing a thread chapter, a paper discussing some issue, might cover that issue both in exotic and in familiar legal systems. But just a modern legal system really is not what we're after. And on the subject of thread chapters, one idea that occurred to me in the last couple of days that might be interesting would be the issue of false accusation. How do different legal systems handle the problem that I want to get you, and so I go to the authorities and I accuse you of something you haven't done, and maybe you get convicted and maybe you get acquitted, but you go through hell before you get acquitted. If you think about, even in our legal system, what the costs are of being tried for a serious crime of which you're innocent, they're very large. You've got to pay for a lawyer, or else you get a court-appointed lawyer who usually isn't very good. You may have to, if you don't put up bail, you might spend 6 months or a year in prison waiting trial. All that when you've done nothing at all. So an interesting question would be how different legal systems deal with that problem. And I know of a few examples, which will come up in the course of the course, but I thought that would be one idea somebody might want to play with. Also, with regard to systems, the course is really looking at Chinese law almost exclusively in the last dynasty. However, turns out that there is, as I think I mentioned before, a web translation of the Tang Code, which was the first really complete code we have records of. There are translations, I'm not sure if webbed or not, of chunks of some of the other early codes. So if somebody wanted to do Chinese law looking at 2,000 years of it, and trying to see if there were interesting patterns or things you could say about it, that might be fun. That's just one more idea that occurred to me. With regard to sources for information, when you're reading secondary sources, books about a legal system, what you really want is mostly information about the legal system, not information about what the author thinks. That in a sense, I'm not interested in scholarship about scholarship, if that makes sense. I'm interested in understanding legal systems. So if the author says this legal system had characteristic X but doesn't give any evidence for it, ignore it. If you see the evidence against it, say so, and so forth. But primary sources, of course, raise a different set of issues. The primary sources are the actual law code written, the treatise written in the 14th century or the 2nd century, depending what it is, and those don't raise that set of problems. One of the patterns you ought to watch for is that, in my experience, people who write about exotic societies are usually biased in favor of them. And I noticed that with regard to Gypsy Law, as I was mentioning, that the editor, at least, clearly wants people to think well of the gypsies and is worried that they won't. It's true of me, that my old article on Icelandic saga period Iceland, pretty clearly part of the tone was, isn't this neat? Weren't these interesting people? Wasn't this a clever way of running the law? I noticed it when I was, a book we're not doing this year, but some past years we've used The Cheyenne Way, which is a book on Cheyenne Indian law, written by an anthropologist and a prominent legal scholar of 70 years ago. And it's very clear that their attitude to the Cheyenne is like my attitude to the Icelanders, that, you know, don't patronize these people. These were grown-ups. They had a working system. Let's try to understand it and take it seriously. And I think that's it's true. One of the things that actually struck me when I was sort of amusing when I was reading the book that you're going to be reading parts of about Chinese law is that the authors go out of their way to tell you that it really was not a terribly brutal and bloody system and they weren't executing lots of people or torturing them to death or anything like that. And then they say, well, contrast that to the bloody code in England where all serious felonies were capital. And, of course, if you read something, people who actually study the bloody code in England, you discover that although all serious felonies were capital on paper, in terms of how the system really worked, most of the people who committed those felonies did not get hanged. So it was sort of a neat symmetry that each of them is believing that the people who know about China take for granted the negative image about 18th century England while they're going to some trouble to defend the Chinese system. So that's, it seems to me, sort of one of the biases that you have to allow for. In all of these. Another problem that you may want to think about is that if there aren't very many experts on a subject, the few that there are might be wrong. That one of the optional readings on Iceland that I listed is a book by William Miller, who does not entirely agree with my view of the Icelandic system. And it's quite likely that one or the other of us has got things in some way wrong, maybe not. Along other lines, I've just been reading more stuff on Chinese law, and one of the points that I've discussed in the past and probably will discuss this time is the argument that Imperial China had elaborate contractual practice with no real contract law, that it was a pure criminal system. And the thing I was just reading, which was written after the book I've been using as my source, cites a particular pair of scholars who argue there really was more civil law than meets the eye in the Chinese system and are criticizing the view that I had picked up from slightly earlier people, according to which it was a pure criminal system. So, you know, ultimately you've got to make up your own minds. I mean, you're in a sense the scholars doing the research as best you can, but you can't just assume that because the one expert on some subject says such and such, it's necessarily true. That's for you to decide by looking at the evidence that's being offered. Any questions on that? Yes. Email them or come in my office hours once I put up office hours, whatever is convenient for you. Sure. And if I have suggestions, I will be happy to make them. It's a joint project. When you're young, you're afraid people will steal your ideas. When you're old, you're afraid they won't. All right, I wanted to mention the last couple of things that we're going to be covering, which I don't think I really got to last time, and then go on to talk about, in general, the subject of threads, the subject of issues that run through many legal systems, both so that you'll know, be alerted to some things you may want to look for when you're reading the chapters and reading the sources, and also to get your ideas on the subject. So as I think I I think I didn't really get to Chinese law when I was giving you a summary of the course last time. And Chinese law has a number of interesting features. One of them is that it's a system which was functioning in roughly the same way for about 1,300 years, with some interregnants. But the Tang Code is written in somewhere around the 7th century, I think. And the Manchu Code, the Qing Code, which is the code that existed until the end of the empire, is estimated that about 40% of it is lifted from the Tang Code. So you're talking about a relatively stable legal system over a period of something like 1,300 years, and that's interesting. But one of the other interesting things about both of those and a bunch of codes in between is that what they're trying to do is to produce a complete mapping from crime to punishment. That is, they're trying to design a system. If you could imagine, if they only had computers, they would have used a computer. A system where, in principle, the magistrate could enter, this is what happened, read the legal text, and it will say the correct punishment for this is 80 blows of the light bamboo. And it's not doable, of course, as they clearly discovered, so that if you look at the actual cases we'll be doing, it's clear that there were a number of ways in which they could, for example, say, well, actually, this particular offense isn't in the list anywhere, even though it's a very long list, but it's rather like that offense, only not quite so bad. So use the punishment for that offense taken one level down. Or one level up in other cases. And there were a variety of other ways in which they could sort of kludge the system, as it were, to get answers that weren't there. But nonetheless, they were trying to do that, and an awful lot of what you will see in the cases is not arguing about whether people are guilty or not. You almost never see that, at least in the cases we've got. It's argument about what's the proper punishment. What are the legal consequences of what happened?
Was guilt presumed?
No, but the cases we've got are essentially appeals court cases from our standpoint. So what's going on is that these are the opinions of the higher level of the system, which is either approving or sending back for retrial the lower level things. True of our system, too, after all, that if you think about how our appeals court decisions, they aren't trying guilt. They're accepting the finding of facts of the lower court. So, yes, something, by the way, if you want some light reading that's actually relevant to the course, there is a series of mystery books by a Dutch sinologist called Van Gulik. The Judge D books is how they're usually referred to. And Judge D is more or less the Chinese Sherlock Holmes. That Van Gulik was a Dutch scholar and, I think, diplomat. And by his account, he was upset about the fact that this would have been maybe before World War II or a little after, somewhere around there, that young Chinese and Japanese students were reading translations of third-rate Western mysteries and didn't realize that there was a whole literature of Chinese mysteries. And so Van Gulik decided to do something about it. And he put together, the first book was basically put together from, I think, two of the 400-year-old or something ones, with his revisions and such into a single story. And I think he may have done that in both Chinese and in English, but at least there was an English version of that. And he then wrote a whole series of short stories and sort of short novels in which Judge D is the detective, and which are written available in English. They're good, and they give you sort of a picture by somebody who really was a serious scholar of what that society looked like. It's interesting, by his account, the big difference between Chinese detective stories and Western detective stories is that the puzzle in the Chinese detective story is not who did it. You normally know that from the beginning, because you're seeing the story from both the criminal side and the detective side. It's how is the detective going to succeed in catching him, essentially. And that's quite interesting and quite a lot of fun. So one of the things that I find intriguing about the Chinese legal system, another one of a bunch of things, when we imagine particularly oppressive governments, one of the features we associate with an oppressive government is trying to compel children to testify against their parents, to betray their parents. In imperial Chinese law, to accuse your parent of a crime of which your parent was guilty was a criminal act by you. It was illegal to report your parent for breaking the law. All right. Now, in the Tang Code, there was an exception for crimes such as treason, but I believe that by the Qing Code, they had removed the exception. And why? Any guess as to why they don't want to have it reported? Yes. That's one explanation is cultural. Those might be correct, but I find them less interesting than trying to figure out functional ones. Yes.
Would that be because of some theory of accomplice liability where they would hold them all culpable after they found out?
Well, but that would just be like a confession. There are various rules associated with that in the Chinese system, but no, I think it's much simpler than that. They are ruling something over 100 million people with a very small elite bureaucracy of scholar officials. And how do you do it? You subcontract the job. So what they're doing is having a system where most law enforcement isn't by the empire. Most of the law enforcement is by the authority structures below the empire, of which the extended family is the important one. And if you give children weapons against their parents, you undercut the authority of the extended family and therefore don't get to... That's at least my theory. I'm not claiming I know it's true, but I think it's consistent. Because if you look at the legal system, there are a bunch of related features. That any offense committed by a junior relative against a senior relative, the punishment is ramped up. Any incentive committed by a senior relative against a junior relative, the punishment is ramped down. So, and there's an elaborate system defining who's junior and who's senior and so forth. So that there are a bunch of respects in which that system looks as though it's designed to reinforce the authority of the extended family. I think that's part of what's going on. But that's one of the interesting things. And the other one is one of them is the one that I was just mentioning may not be true. Namely that, at least if you believe the book that we're reading, it's all criminal law and no civil law, and yet if you believe another reading, which I think I'm also assigning you, they have elaborate contractual practice. And so, I'm not sure if that's still required reading or optional reading, but the chapter discussing contractual practice in Taiwan in about 1900, as recorded by the Japanese after they annexed Taiwan. Because they wanted to enforce Chinese law rather than trying to enforce Japanese law. To enforce Chinese law, you have to find out what it is. So that's also interesting if true. May or may not be true. Anyway, those are the things, sort of a very brief summary of some of the fun things about the Chinese legal system. And the final one, which I hope we'll get to, is a book which arguably owes at least a little bit of its content to this course. Peter Leeson is an economist at George Mason. And he has written quite a very interesting book on 18th century piracy, an economist's attempts to make sense of that industry, essentially. And I first encountered his work when I was asked to referee an article he had written. This is before the book on the subject. And part of the reason I was able to referee the article and to say interesting and hopefully useful things was that students of mine had done papers in this course on 18th century piracy. So I actually knew something about it. And so I refereed, I think, a couple of Peter's articles. And then when he had a book manuscript, the publisher sent that to me for comments. And so I refereed the book manuscript, and then he published the book. And so I feel that this course has some particular claim to that book, even though he would probably have thought up most of it without us. But it's an interesting book because he's doing what we do in this course. He's trying both to figure out what was happening and to make sense of it. So that, for example, why do you have a skull and crossbones? Why do pirates want to tell people that they're pirates? The reason they want to tell people they are pirates has two features of the system. One of them is they want a reputation. The reputation they want is, if you surrender and don't give us any trouble, you'll get home alive just fine. We'll loot everything we want. If we don't want the ship, we'll give you the ship back after we've taken the more valuable cargo. But if you fight us, we're really nasty people to fight. So therefore, surrender. Perfectly sensible strategy. The problem was they had competitors. And their competitors were the Coast Guards. That this is 18th century, and the Coast Guards were ships in various countries which were supposed to be operating within the territorial waters of those countries, enforcing their rules against smuggling and other things. And the problem was that the pirates didn't want the Coast Guards to free ride on the pirates' reputation. Because, of course, if you're a smuggler, you also want to run away or fight and would also be deterred from doing so if people say it would fit you nicely if and so forth. So since the Coast Guards were quite explicitly not pirates, if the pirates had a way of distinguishing themselves, namely flags that were recognized as saying, I am a pirate, the Coast Guards mostly couldn't hoist such flags without getting in trouble back home because they weren't supposed to be pirates, and therefore the pirates could take advantage of the reputation they were creating without losing out to the Coast Guard. And it's a neat theory, and he may even be right. I don't know that it's right. Other interesting things. One of my favorite bits of the book is the question of whether or not the pirates drafted people. All right? Pirates take a ship. The ship's got sailors on it. Do the pirates say to the tell of the ship, sailors, you're now pirates along with us, or do they not? And according to Peter, the answer was they occasionally drafted someone if they needed some particular skill, say a blacksmith. But what they usually did was they first found out which of the sailors they had captured wanted to join them, and they then made a show of forcing those people to join them and sending the rest of them home. Why did they do that? Because the pirates who joined the ship would have their friends who weren't joining it put an ad in the newspaper back home saying so-and-so was compelled to join pirate ship XYZ, with the result that if the pirate ship was taken, he had at least a chance of convincing the court that he hadn't willingly engaged in piracy and therefore shouldn't be hanged. So I thought that was quite neat. And he's got the ads. Yes?
So that, like, you know, when a world leadership, you know, took a prize and that they would send some portion of their crew over as a prize crew to take it back to, you know, Portsmouth or whatever, would the pirates occasionally use the crew of a ship they captured as a prize crew to bring it back to, like, Tortuga or whatever?
I don't think, he doesn't at least mention that happening. You have to look at that, or you could email Peter and ask him. He's at George Mason if you want to find his email address. But it's a lot of fun. The puzzle that I had, which I think I know the answer to, though he isn't explicit enough about it, the general puzzle is why the institutions of the pirates were so different from the institutions of everybody else, from both the British Navy and the merchant ships. And in particular, why weren't the merchant ships democratic? If democracy works for running pirate ships, why didn't you have merchant ships where the crew ran things, which is basically what was happening with the pirates? And the answer, I think, is that the merchant ships have a large capital value of the ship itself and the cargo. If the crew is making the decisions, the crew will make the decisions not to maximize the welfare of the merchant whose cargo they're carrying and the owner of the ship, because the crew couldn't afford to buy a ship themselves, but to maximize their own welfare. And you therefore need a captain who is essentially imposing on the crew, acting in their employer's interest rather than their own interest. And they say, well, what about the pirate ships? And I think the answer is that a pirate ship was almost worthless. And my evidence for that is that when they took ships, they frequently either sent them home again with what was left of their crew or else sunk them. And I think what's going on is they have a surplus of ships because they're capturing ships, that it's too hard to resell stolen ships, given the ships are pretty identifiable. Therefore, the only really valuable asset on a pirate ship was the crew, and therefore it makes sense that the crew makes decisions in their own interest. But in any case, it's a fun book, and hopefully we'll have enough time to cover it. And if not, you can read it yourself anyway. So that's, I think, the full list of the legal systems that we're presently planning to cover, not including the multiple legal systems I'm going to discover from your papers, which will hopefully be interesting and which we will hear about when you, each of you, conduct a bit of this class towards the end of the semester. Let me talk a bit about threads and sort of thread-like objects, about common issues that run through a bunch of legal systems. And let me start with one that I mentioned before, which is embedded legal systems. When you have a sub-society trying to enforce its own rules on its own people. And one issue that raises is how you enforce it. Where the obvious answer is you either do illegal things that the ruling society doesn't care about or doesn't notice, such as killing people who they don't think matter very much, or you do legal things that impose costs on people, such as ostracizing people as enforcement mechanism, as punishment. Another general issue is how you interact with the superior legal system. So that we've got, on the one hand, the gypsies, where the real answer is you make yourself as hard to see as possible and stay under the radar. You've got the diaspora Jewish community where the answer is basically you've got a contract with the ruler agreeing that you'll pay him taxes and he'll let you enforce your own rules on your own people. But you then have, it occurred to me, a third example, which is the Somali situation back when the British were still running, in theory, northern Somalia. Because that was a system in which the Somali were mostly settling things by their own existing feud system. But there were British officials and they had presumably some number of soldiers and such to do stuff with. And one of the fun bits in one of the books I read about Somalia is that the way the Somali dealt with this situation is that Group A is going to attack Group B for some reason. So what they do is send a message or leak the information to the British authorities about the attack, but they leak it late enough so that the British authorities won't be there when the attack occurs. They will, however, show up before Group B retaliates. And since the British authorities disapprove of Somali shooting at each other, the theory is that you're gaming the over authority, as it were, in order to help with your feud. Make sense? Doesn't make sense? So I thought that was an interesting sort of third possibility that you neither cooperate with nor hide from, but rather manipulate the official rulers. And I suspect if we knew more, say, about the Sicilian mafia, you might well discover similar patterns going on there. That's one which, that's a very interesting society, which maybe someday I'll include in the course, but I haven't yet. The next issue, which goes along sort of with that, is polylegal systems. Systems where you've got societies, you have multiple legal systems in the same territory. And one of the puzzles for that, and for the polylegal system I'm most interested in, which is Islamic law, I don't really have an adequate answer, and I'm not sure anybody does, is what determines what court handles the cross cases. In other words, I'm a part of a community that follows the Maliki school of law. You're part of a community that follows the Shafi'i school of law. We have a legal conflict. What court does it go to? And I think from stuff I've seen that nobody has a general answer to that. That there may have been particular times and places where the answer was the Ottoman rulers are Hanafi, and therefore in case of doubt you go to a Hanafi court. There seem to have been places where it may have been the plaintiff's court and places where it may have been the defendant's. And if you think about it, that matters. Because if you have a system, insofar as they differ, a system where the court is the plaintiff's court is likely to result in more litigation than one where it's the defendant's court, because the plaintiff is going to decide to be a plaintiff knowing that it's the legal system he approves of that it'll be under. But I don't know of a general answer, and it's sort of an interesting question when you're running polylegal systems, and as you know, it's a very complicated issue in our system with regard to questions of jurisdiction. Notice that another interesting feature of a polylegal system is that it provides useful flexibility where there isn't a conflict. So let us suppose that you and I want to set up a partnership. We're medieval Muslims. And this partnership is under particular kind of contractual terms. And these terms are terms which three of the four schools disapprove of. The fourth school approves of them. So we go to a court of that fourth school. We register our contract or whatever they're doing with that court. It then follows that any disputes with that contract will be settled by that court, and we have now, in effect, gotten our choice of law. This is not a radical idea. Where are most U.S. corporations located? Oddly enough, in Delaware, despite the fact that Delaware is a rather small state, and presumably what's going on is the same thing. Delaware, for whatever reason, has a set of legal rules that people who form corporations like to be under, and consequently they choose to do it that way. So that's another, it seems to me, an interesting feature, and one which sort of echoes our things. All right, the next thread that I was mentioning was, I should say, stop me at any point if you think of things that ought to be added, right? If a problem about a polylegal system that I've ignored occurs to you, please tell me, because this book is not finished and you are supposed to help me write it. And similarly with the other things I've said, it's sometimes hard to stop me from talking, but it is doable with a little effort and courage. So another set of issues is how you enforce the law. And the first question is who enforces it? And in practice, that really sort of divides into two questions. One of them is who takes the actions necessary to get a legal result, and then who enforces that legal result. So that if you think about our system, Who is it who is responsible for seeing that illegal acts go to court?
Prosecutor.
That's one person. Who else? Yeah, everybody in the room, right? If you're the victim of a tort, it is your responsibility to call up a lawyer. And when you become lawyers, you'll be a lawyer somebody else calls up. So, in fact, in our system, the first half of that, finding out that an offense has occurred and getting it to court and getting a result, is done by the state in the criminal system and by private actors in the tort system. On the other hand, in our system, the second step, which is actually enforcing it, is supposed to be done by the state. That is, that after you get your tort judgment, you don't have to actually, you know, go into the guy's bank with a gun and say, all right, he owes me $10,000, take it out of his account and give it to me. You're supposed to be able to get the state to do that for you. So, as we're going to see, private, in terms of the prosecution stage of it, the private party is the person who essentially always does it, almost always does it in Athenian law. This is Periclean Athens. This is Athens a little more than 2,000 years ago. In the gypsy, in both versions of the gypsy law, I think it's true. In the Icelandic, it's true. Notice that there are actually two different variants of private prosecution. One of them is prosecution by the victim, and the other is prosecution by anybody. So that in our tort law, I can't sue for a tort against you. Or more precisely, in practice, I can do it maybe in the context of a class action. All right, a class action is an evasion of that rule, as it were. But the ordinary tort case, it's got to be the victim or somebody acting for the victim. On the other hand, in 18th century English criminal law, any Englishman could prosecute any crime. Are there any equivalents of that in our system? Anybody know?
Oh, citizen yeah. Suit?
Citizen action for a crime. Citizen action for something that would normally be a state action. I think the term is private attorney general, and I believe there are some statutes which provide that a private individual can initiate what's in effect a criminal suit. Maybe, I don't know if it's legally criminal or civil, but in the sense it's a suit not for injury to him, but for a violation of a rule. It turns out in England, on paper, it is still possible, under some circumstances, to have private prosecution of criminal cases. And there was a fairly high-profile case, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, where I think a young man was killed by a gang or something, and the police concluded they didn't have enough evidence to convict anybody, and then I think his family or his friends or something initiated a private prosecution and failed. The police were right. They didn't have enough evidence to get a conviction. But it was interesting that it still happened. And if you read Blackstone, who is sort of the great 18th century English legal writer, he describes a legal form called an appeal of felony, which was a private suit with a criminal punishment. And his comment there, he says it's really a dead letter, that it's still in the law, but by the 18th century it's not really happening. But his comment is that if you were convicted on the appeal of felony, the king cannot pardon you, because the king was not a party to the suit, unlike an ordinary criminal suit. So one of the interesting things in English law is the way in the Middle Ages criminal prosecution is in part at least private. By some later point, it's public, but then if you look at what's really happening by the 18th century, it's legally public, but actually private, because the crown is not doing the prosecution. It's just that the case is the king versus so-and-so. So it's, anyway. But in the Athenian case, which we'll get to much later, there is one set of cases which are like our tort cases where only the victim can prosecute, but then there's another set of cases where any adult male Athenian citizen can prosecute, and where typically the prosecutor gets a share of the fine if the person is convicted. That's the incentive to prosecute, which is obviously one of the issues. There's another sort of legal system, broadly defined, we discussed this last time, which you also enforce. Enforce as well as prosecute, and that's norms. All right, if you think about the action you take if somebody you know has been acting badly, whatever that means, all right, and that what do? You gossip, You tell other people about it. You maybe refuse to associate with that person or associate with that person at more of a distance. You do various things which act as punishments, all right, and which are a reason not to behave in that way. Case I'm thinking of, actually, which I heard only secondhand through my daughter, was somebody in World of Warcraft who was basically trying to engage in romantic activities with a bunch of different women at once without letting any of them know about the others. I don't remember if he was actually doing it under different names, because, of course, in World of Warcraft you can have multiple personae, but it pretty clearly he was at least aiming eventually at real-world involvement, and somehow he got caught, and a lot of people wouldn't talk to him for quite a while thereafter. So that's a form of rule enforcement, right? It's not quite what we think of as laws, but it's going in that direction. And you can think of a lot of other cases. I won't ask you to tell me your secrets about your friends and enemies, but probably many of you can think of cases where somebody you knew behaved badly, the fact became known, and the person suffered as a result. Now, one of the interesting issues about that kind of enforcement is associated with the issue of enforcing contracts via reputation, which is another interesting question, though. We'll get into it a little bit later, but not very much, is that when you, at least in theory, when the police arrest you for a crime, the reason is they want to stop crimes. When you discover that a firm has treated people badly. Suppose you discover that the firm said money back if you complain, and then a friend of yours complained and didn't get his money back. Why do you stop doing business with the firm? Is it because you're trying to punish them mainly? You're protecting yourself. That's right. So that's a case where the enforcement part of reputation and contracts is a side effect, not the deliberate purpose. All right, that the criminal law enforcement system, at least in theory, maybe I don't know in practice or not, the reason the cops are arresting people is to stop crime. Maybe not. Maybe there are other reasons, but that's at least we hope the reason. But the reason that you shun someone who behaved badly is at least largely to protect yourself, not to punish him. But it has the effect of punishing him, and therefore works in the same way. And that sort of gets into the whole question of the incentive to prosecute. So if you think about how you arrange that people who do bad things will get prosecuted and eventually get punished, one of the problems is how to get enough incentive. And what do we think of as sort of the standard mechanism for how you make sure that people who do bad things get prosecuted? How do we do it? Same way the French did in the 18th century and the Chinese did it. We have paid professional employees called public prosecutors and police whose job it is to do that. Now, how well that works, one doesn't know, because, of course, saying that it's your job to do something doesn't tell us whether you do it. You can certainly imagine corrupt systems where the people whose job it is to prosecute crime really see their job as punishing people who didn't pay them off. There's an interesting book in terms of organized crime, which is an interesting subject to try to make sense of. There's a book called The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano. And Luciano was a major Prohibition-era mobster. And the book at least claims to be based on interviews with him after he had involuntarily retired back to Italy by a newspaper man type person. And I think it's real. You can't. Books like that, it's hard to be certain whether the author is making it up or whether it's really from Luciano. But I think it's from Luciano. And one of the things I thought interesting was his description of his industry, because he was running one of four relatively small firms doing criminal things. And the four firms were a single firm for one purpose, and that was corruption, that there were economies of scale in bribing police and judges. And therefore, the four firms, in effect, had a pooled operation for buying police and judges, but then other than that, ran their independent criminal enterprises themselves. Now, that was intriguing. But in any case, one possible mechanism is a system in which you have government employees for that job. And I should say one of the interesting things about the Chinese system was, not being naive, they had other government employees, even higher status, whose job was watching the first set of employees. That the censors has a different meaning to us, But in Imperial China, the censorate was the part of the government in charge of catching government officials who were doing bad things, corrupt government officials. And in the Chinese had, as I may have mentioned, invented the civil service examination system. They invented it more than 1,000 years ago. And their system was one in which almost everyone could take the exam, but you had to have had the time to study extensively in the Chinese classics, because it was an exam in literature and poetry and calligraphy and that sort of stuff, which you wouldn't think was what you wanted for officials, but how they did it. Maybe it was really an IQ exam. I don't know if you think about the effect. But if you scored very well on that, you end up as a district magistrate, which means that you're the combination prosecutor, judge, chief of police, and governor for a population of 200,000 people or so. If you do even better than that, you end up as a censor, which means you're going around the provinces trying to see if the provincial governors are really doing their job or not, and reporting them if they don't. So that was sort of an intriguing system for trying to deal with that problem. So in any case, that's one way of doing it, and it's the way we tend to take for granted, having it done by paid professionals with that job. And I guess from the standpoint of those of us who are sort of extreme free market types, we are a little suspicious of that, because we say, look, governments don't do a very good job of producing food. That's why they had famines in Russia. They don't do a very good job of producing cars. Why do you think they do a good job of producing law enforcement? So that might be an argument to want to look at some of the decentralized models. In terms of decentralized models, one of the very common ones, which we use, is the prosecution is by the victim and his incentive is a damage payment. All right? That's the reason, usually, that you sue somebody in tort is to collect money from them. That's also the way the Icelandic system worked, with a wider range of torts than ours, because killing people was a tort. And it's also the way blood feuds among the gypsies work, as we will see pretty soon when you start reading about the Roman Chal gypsies, where basically the reason I threaten to beat you up is so that you will compensate me because you cheated me, and you owe me some compensation for that. Another system used by us and by the Athenians and various other people is a bounty, not a damage payment. So if you think about the criminal cases in Pericles in Athens, I am prosecuting you not because you've done anything to me, but because you've broken the law, and when you're convicted, you're going to pay a fine, and I'm going to get a third or so of that fine. Similar systems that we're familiar with are bounty systems. If you think about wanted, dead or alive, $100. I was actually looking at some old posters for some reason, I think in a restaurant or something from that time, and I was wondering, because it looked to me as though the people who were wanted hadn't actually been convicted yet. Because it was something like, it was in the form of something like, the people who committed such and such a crime, we think they are so and so. Well, but wait a minute, after they're dead, when you bring them in dead, how do you try them? Yeah?
My impression that the dead or alive wasn't usually or it was usually born alive. If you brought him in dead, you got like a big reduction in your fee.
Yeah, I don't know. Interesting question. I don't know enough about it. It might be. It's getting a little bit close to our time to be a suitable subject for this course, but I am curious about how those systems actually worked. But there are other ways. Let's go to the case of the English criminal prosecution, because for most of the 18th century, if you proved that somebody had stolen your horse, you might get the horse back if it was still around, but you didn't even owe you any damages because it was a criminal system, not a tort system. So aside from recovering my property, why do I bother to prosecute people who committed crimes against me?
So
that one way is to get a reputation. That is, if I thought it was the same person who would do it again, then just getting him hanged would do it too. But in the more general case, one reason is deterrence as a private good, and there are some practical problems with that though, because imagine that you're sort of a random victim of theft. Doesn't happen very often. There are a lot of people in your town. Is it really going to be practical for your one case of getting the thief hanged to result in all of the other potential thieves knowing that you're the person not to rob from? Maybe hard. that basically for the reputation mechanism to work, you really want to be a repeat player. You want to be somebody who's victim often enough so that you can establish a reputation. And they had a very elegant solution to this problem. Their solution to that problem was something called an association for the prosecution of felons. So you have a bunch of people in one town in England, and they chip in an annual dues of a pound or two, in exchange for which the money will be available to pay the cost of prosecuting anybody who commits a felony against any of them. And so far it sounds like an insurance scheme. But the final step is the list of the members of the association is published in the newspaper for the felons to read. So what you're doing is pre-committing. If you think about, let's think about revenge in general. There are lots of situations where it is in my interest for it to be the case that if you hurt me, I'll hurt you. But often, if you do hurt me, it's not in my interest to hurt you. At that point, the deterrence has failed. If you imagine any case where you're talking about relatively uncommon things. So suppose, for example, I want to make sure that I don't get killed. So my brother and I announce, if anybody kills my brother, I'm going to go get him, and vice versa. All right? Now somebody kills my brother. Well, it's too late to save my brother. And if I go kill the guy who does it, I might get killed in the process. I mean, they can fight back after all. So it looks like a situation where I'm better off if people believe that I'll carry through the commitment, but it's not clear when it really happens if it's my interest to carry through the commitment. Right? Problem? And so the advantage of the association with the prosecution of felons is that I have pre-committed. I've already spent the money, which is the cost in that case. And I have pre-committed and announced my pre-commitment. I've locked myself in. People know the story about Odysseus and the sirens. This is the most famous story in literature about pre-commitment. The sirens sang so sweetly that sailors leaped out of their ships and drowned. So Odysseus had to go past where the sirens were. And so he had his whole crew put wax in their ears so they couldn't hear the sirens. But Odysseus was a hero. He wasn't going to put wax in his ears. He wanted to hear this magnificent singing. So he had his men tie him to the mast. And he gave them orders, whatever I say, don't untie me until we're past the sirens. And he tried, when he comes, they come in range of the sirens, and he's struggling, trying to break the ropes and plunge into the sea to swim to the sirens, but fortunately he doesn't make it, and they get out of range of the sirens, and they release him, and thus Odysseus is, I suppose, the only living man to have heard the sirens and lived. That's a commitment story. All right, he's committing himself by getting tied. And the story I've just told you is a commitment story, and as I think I mentioned in the last class, this class is a commitment story. This class is how I committed myself to learn lots of interesting stuff by putting me in a situation where I was obliged to do so in order that I have things to teach in the class. So commitments are relevant in lots and lots of different systems. There's another, at least one other way which on the evidence gave you an incentive to prosecute in the English 18th century case. Let's imagine for a moment that somebody has stolen something from you and you think you can prove it. One thing you might do, you start a court case. And after you started the court case, you realize that the court case is a certain amount of trouble for you, you're not getting anything from it. What might it occur you to do? And this should be an easy answer for all of you would-be lawyers, because that's right, out-of-court settlement. All right, what you do is you say to him, you know, I could get you hanged. How much is it worth to you not to? All right, so I think the evidence is pretty good. In English 18th century law, that was illegal. But I think it's pretty clear that it also happened. That in fact, I can't remember the technical term, but there was a legal offense of basically getting paid off to drop prosecution. But there is a set of papers which I read in the University of Chicago Law School Library, and I don't know if we have them or not, called the Rider Documents, which were basically notes by an 18th century English judge about cases. And it's clear from some of the cases he describes that you've got somebody, it's a case where a store owner is accusing a girl of having done shoplifting. And the store owner goes to the girl's mother and basically tries to get her to pay him off to drop charges. And she doesn't, and in fact the girl's acquitted. I don't know if she was really guilty or not. But you can see the pattern going on, and I think that's pretty clearly one of the things that's happening. So that's another incentive that you might have to prosecute. Let's go on to norms. All right. One incentive to enforce norms is, as we mentioned before, that it's in your private interest to do so. There's no cost at all to your shunning the person who you know might be bad news to get associated with because he treats people badly. But there's another possible reason. Suppose somebody is viewed by a lot of people in your society as having behaved badly and you're friends with him. What do you think is going to happen? Your reputation will go down. So to some extent, it's contagious. And there are some societies, this is quite explicit, where among the gypsies, for example, pollution, the Romani word for pollution is marame, and various things you can do get you polluted. And one of the things that gets you polluted is associating with people who are polluted. So that's a sort of, I think of it as the bootstrap solution. You raise yourself by your own bootstraps. Norm systems where one of the rules of the norm is that not enforcing the norm is a norm violation. All right, where the fact that you don't shun the person who has done whatever violation of norms is going on means you're a person who's violated norms that other people should shun, and you don't want to be shunned, so that gives you an incentive to enforce it. So that's a sort of a weird self-consistent mechanism, which I think you actually observe working in a variety of societies. In some cases, in a number of the cases that I know of, it sort of interacts with religious or magical beliefs. So the Cheyenne, who we're not covering this year, if a Cheyenne kills another Cheyenne, with or without excuse, as far as I can tell, he's out of the tribe. Why is he out of the tribe? Because he smells of death. And the smell of death is bad luck and is contagious. And after 10 years or so, he may be able to persuade the tribe to let him back in. But for the rest of his life, nobody will ever smoke his pipe or eat from his bowl. Because although he doesn't smell as badly of death as he did right after the killing, there's still enough left so that too close association it might be catching. And along somewhat similar lines in Athenian law, there is the idea that a killer is polluting, and that therefore somebody who's committed murder ought not to be in various religious ceremonies or in the courts, that will spread to other people as a result. And there's quite a neat case we'll come about later where some people are trying to evade an amnesty. All right, there's been essentially a sort of a civil war, a temporary dictatorship in which some people are killed, and then the ending of this. This is at the end of the Peloponnesian War when Athens was conquered by Sparta. Spartans installed an oligarchy. The oligarchy rules for a while and kills some of their enemies, and then they go back to democracy. And part of the deal when they go back to democracy was a pardon for all crimes that occurred under the oligarchy. And you then have somebody who wants to get one of the oligarchs for something he did. And he says, well, look, I'm not claiming that he can be punished for anything he did under that. But he is a murderer. And after the pardon, he went into temples and courts. Well, the fact that he's pardoned means we can't prosecute him for that murder. But he's still polluted. And therefore, he was still polluting other things. We'll prosecute him for that. Not sure what finally came of that case, but it was sort of an ingenious way of trying to avoid an amnesty, essentially. You could probably imagine modern equivalents of that with a little effort. So all of those are ways that you get incentive to prosecute. And then the flip side is how do you avoid having too much incentive to prosecute? So that in Imperial China, I should probably warn you that if you ever get into a time machine and go back to China in the 19th century, you had better not tell them that you're a lawyer. Because the term for lawyer is legal trickster, and it's a criminal offense. You aren't supposed to be giving legal advice to people unless you're a state official. And presumably, though one doesn't know for sure, but presumably what at least the people who were making those rules thought was going on was that if people knew too much about the law, they could game the law in various ways. And in fact, it seems to be the case that one of the earlier dynasties, it was illegal to publish the laws, that the laws were for use within the bureaucracy and the common people weren't supposed to know them. The common people were supposed to know, as good Confucians, what right action was, and the details of exactly what happened thereafter, as long as they acted right, they wouldn't get into any trouble. But in general, you'll see that in some of the cases. In Athens, there are two reasons, actually, why you might prosecute somebody for something he didn't do. One of them was for the fine. And the other reason was as part of a feud, basically, that you've got Athenians who are political enemies of each other and want to get each other into trouble. And the Athenians had a solution to this problem. For a criminal case, they have big juries, several hundred people in a jury. And in a criminal case, if you fail to get at least a fifth of the jury to vote for conviction, the prosecutor is fined. 1,000 drachma fine. Roughly 3 years' wages for an ordinary working man. So not a huge amount if he's really rich, but still more than a tap on the wrist. Think of it as $150,000 fine in our system, roughly. Furthermore, in the Athenian system for their equivalent of tort cases, for some tort cases that you lost, and we don't know enough to know if this was all cases or if it depended on getting less than a fifth of the vote or what, but for at least some subset of tort cases, the losing plaintiff owes the prevailing defendant 1/6 of the amount the plaintiff claimed. 1 obol in the drachma, because there were 6 obols to the drachma. And that's really an intriguing idea. I've actually got an article on my webpage. I haven't tried submitting it yet, though I will somewhere eventually, in which I'm discussing the patent troll problem, and in which I suggest that one of the problems with our legal system is that given that the legal system makes mistakes, if you sue an innocent person, there is some chance you'll win. Therefore, when you sue an innocent person, you're imposing a cost on him, and like other acts that impose costs, you ought to be liable for it. And if you sue an innocent person and win, we don't know he's innocent, so we can't punish you. But we could say that if you sue a person and he's acquitted, since if somebody is convicted by a 55% probability, we treat it as if we were certain he's guilty. He pays the whole amount. We could say, well, if he's acquitted because it's less than 50%, we treat it as if we know he was innocent. Therefore, you're guilty of suing an innocent person. Therefore, you should owe him a penalty. And one of the interesting features of that is that if you did it the way the Athenians did, where when you sued somebody, you had to specify the amount you were suing him for, it also gives you an incentive not to oversue. Because if you imagine the case where we say, if you lose, you will owe a sixth of the amount you claimed, instead of saying, well, we're going to sue for $100 million and then settle for $1 million, you say, we're going to sue for $100 million. Oops, if we lose, we're going to owe him a fortune. Maybe we better just sue for the amount we really think we're entitled to start with. So that's sort of an interesting thought coming out of the Athenian system. But it's a good idea. I don't know. When I talk about this stuff outside of the law school, people want to know what's the best legal system. And the answer is, I don't know what's the best legal system. And there probably isn't even a best legal system in different societies. They just want to understand them. Yes?
Do you find in your experience that societies with a kind of more democratic structure tend to change tradition more often?
Huh, that's an interesting question. That is certainly the Athenians do have a fair amount of legislation. And Imperial China, they're continually changing the details, but the general structure is very stable. Iceland, they have a legislature, and I don't know whether you'd call it democratic or not, given how that system works, because seats in the legislature are private property, transferable private property. I don't know. It's an interesting question whether what the interaction is. As one of the threads that we'll eventually get to is how law gets made. And one interesting question is how that interacts with what actually happens to it. Whether if you think about, see, you could argue that one of the virtues of an oral legal system is that you can change it without admitting you're changing it. That if you have an oral system, there's no written text to look at. So if it becomes pretty clear that really we should do this instead of that, then the judges who decide cases say that's what our traditional rule is, and nobody disagrees, and after a while it's the traditional rule. Whereas with a written system, somebody can actually point at the text, and then you have to have some mechanism for amending it. So I think you can at least argue that oral legal systems might be more flexible than written ones. In both 18th century England and in Periclean Athens, it's illegal to drop a case once you've commenced it. It's not clear how enforceable that was in either case, because in Athens it looks as though you could effectively drop it by essentially asking for a postponement and then never coming back. But at least in theory, that both of those systems are preventing it. And one possible reason is that they were worried about people suing someone with deep pockets in order to settle out of court for, you know, 10 cents on the dollar when the person really did nothing wrong. I don't know if that's what they're worried about, but at least you do have restrictions on dropping it. How do you... In the modern American case, of course, the cases we worry about too much incentive for, one of them is class actions and punitive damages. We're worried about in tort. Where do we worry about too much incentive for enforcing criminal law?
Where?
What, in what part of our legal system are some people afraid? Yes.
Contingent fees for results in criminal cases, that you can't, like, you know, in civil cases, you know, you can arrange for your client to pay no fee, but then pay you 30% of a judgment, you know?
But
you can't do it. Those are illegal in criminal cases.
How would you do it in the criminal case? Because the prosecution is by a state official anyway.
I don't really know, but all I know is that it's something that pays the NPRE.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is exactly what you're looking for, but in general, people who are more successful will be promoted to higher places, so there's incentive to.
That's right. There certainly is the worry. I know one person who, I don't know, 30 years ago or something, as far as I can tell, was convicted of a crime he hadn't committed and has been sort of unhappy about it ever since. And his view is that the system is simply designed to convict as many people as possible. That's not how they think about it, but that's how the incentives really run. That if you want to make a good reputation as a DA, you don't want to lose cases. So once somebody's been arrested, you want to convict them. So you could certainly worry about that problem. But there's also a much more direct one, and that's the problem of civil forfeiture. That anybody here know about civil forfeiture? One person
does
it.
When property is seized, if cops raid a drug or something like that, they seize all the drugs, you can bring an action to forfeit that property to the state, and they get to keep it. And presumably, you know, I don't know if it's a drug, but if it's a house or a car, they can sell.
And they do not have to demonstrate that the owner has done anything wrong.
Oh, yeah.
They do not have to convict anybody of any crime. It is a civil action, not a criminal action, with civil standards of proof. So the police say, your teenage kid sold marijuana from your porch, your house is now ours. And if you want to contest it, we've got to fail to demonstrate by a civil standard that the house was used in the committing of a crime. The question of whether the owners of the house are guilty is irrelevant. The Supreme Court, I think the law was changed a bit by Congress a while ago, so I may be making it a little worse than it now is. But the Supreme Court case on this was one where a man picks up a prostitute in a car which he owns jointly with his wife. The car forfeits. The wife asks to get her half back, and the court refuses. So she not only had not committed a crime, arguably she was in some sense the victim of the crime, and nonetheless she's losing property. So that's something people worry about. And there's a law professor in Florida who I know who argues that one of the main sources of the war on drugs was a change in the law, that essentially the situation used to be that state forfeiture law was designed to have the value forfeited go as far as possible from the police department. So the property forfeited and the money went into the education fund or something. At some point, there was federal law in which a state or local law enforcement could, in effect, let the federal law enforcement adopt the forfeiture, and they could then share the money with the local law enforcement. And at least according to the guy who I know about this, this resulted in a sharp increase in enforcement actions on the war on drugs because it was a good opportunity to forfeit stuff. What I do know is that a fair number of years ago, I got a call from somebody who said would I be interested in speaking at a conference on money laundering in the Pacific Rim. He explained that his profession was forensic accountant, which I thought was a sort of a neat profession. And I said, well, you do realize that I'm in favor of money laundering, don't you? And he said, yes. So I attended. It was very interesting, and most of the people were law enforcement people. And there was a series of talks describing one set of law enforcement actions, which I remembered brought in more than $100 million. certainly a very, it was many million, and I think it was more than 100 million. So you can certainly see that you're going to worry both that law enforcement is going to convict innocent people if they can get money out of it, and that law enforcement, in setting its priorities, instead of asking what crimes do most damage, ask what crimes are most likely to be committed to by people who have property we can seize, and go after them. So that's a potential problem in the modern system. But all of these sort of run through all of the systems, in effect, that 18th century England, in the middle of the 18th century, for a while, there are rewards for convicting criminals of a particular narrow set of crimes, which highway robbery, I think, was one of them. So that basically people were worried there wasn't enough incentive to prosecute criminals. And so they put up the rewards, and they're big rewards. I worked it out in terms of wages at the time, and you're talking about the equivalent of $100,000 or so in modern terms relative to their wages. And so then there are a series of scandals. Either what happens is entrapment. The real criminal goes to some Irishman fresh off the boat who doesn't know from nothing about what's going on in England and says, "Hey, Paddy, we can make a lot of money robbing a stagecoach." And they then set it up so that he's the one who's robbing the stagecoach, they're the ones who betray him, and they collect the reward. And there were other cases where it looks as though the crime never happened, as though you're basically framing somebody for a pretend crime in order to collect the reward. And after a few years, they abolish the rewards. Casanova, real person, as you may or may not know. Casanova's memoirs are my very favorite 18th century primary source because he was an interesting guy. He went everywhere from London to Moscow. He associated with lots of important and interesting people, and he writes very well. And he mentions during his visit to London that there was a sign he saw in the windows of some shops. He never told us what the words were. But he asked some English friends what this sign meant, and they said it means perjured testimony for sale here. So you can see that's one of the things you have to worry about in all of these systems, that you want to think about how people will game the system for their own purposes. An issue with regard to litigants gaming the system, that's another interesting category, and presumably the Chinese attempt to prevent private lawyers as part of it. But the Icelanders have a very simple solution to gaming the system, and it goes as follows. You kill my brother. You then do various things to make it hard for me to sue you. So I kill you. And now when the case goes to court, your family owes me weregeld for killing my brother. My family, or I owe you weregeld for killing you. Cancels. We're done. So that's one of the risks of trying to game the system. And you see cases in the sagas where people are either doing or threatening to do that, essentially, where somebody is taking advantage of legal trickery of one sort or another. We may get to one of those later. Another interesting question for all legal systems is whether you judge outcomes or actors. And let me put it in terms of what I find an interesting puzzle, which is, it's a twofold puzzle. One half is, why do we punish attempted murder? And the other half is, why do we punish it differently from actual murder? Do people see why those are both puzzles? I shot at you and missed. I hit a tree. You're fine. The tree's fine. Why should I have any criminal punishment? All right. If you're judging it by outcome, it looks as though I've done nothing wrong. On the other hand, being a bad shot is not a moral virtue. So I'm just as bad a person if I shoot at you and miss as if I shoot at you and hit. So why is the penalty for attempted murder lower than the penalty for actual murder? All right, I'll let you think about that. If this were a law and econ class, we'd go into this in more detail because I think it's an interesting puzzle. But the point I want to make at the moment is that there are two different intuitions, as it were, about criminal punishment in general, that I think most of us have both of them. And one of them is you're punishing somebody for the result of what he did. And the other is that you're punishing him for what it says about him because he's an evil person. So that on the one hand, we have this feeling that if you did something terrible, but you weren't evil, you know, you shot an innocent person. Why did you shoot an innocent person? Because you thought he was attacking you. You know, he was an actor in a play, and he had a gun, and you didn't know there was a play being, or a movie being filmed or something, and so it looked to you like he was killing somebody, and you shot him. Well, not clear, sort of. Part of our intuition is you're not guilty because you didn't have intent in our legal system. You're not bad. But at the same time, we also have this sort of other feeling that it ought to be what happens that matters. That, again, let me give you a different version of the same puzzle. Suppose you know that somebody you knew driving at night ran down and killed a small child. You'll feel really horribly about it. Suppose you knew that he almost killed a small child. He was driving, there was a small child in the way, he just managed to swerve out of the way. Well, you'd still be a little worried that he was driving carelessly, but you don't have the same feeling of pollution. All right? It really is a feeling of pollution, just like the Cheyenne and the Athenians. So that part of your reaction really is that the moral status of his action is what happened. And the other is that the status is what does it tell us about him. So you can think of legal systems, some of which, like the Cheyenne response to killing people, you're not a bad person. He was trying to kill you and you killed him in self-defense. Nonetheless, you killed a fellow Cheyenne. Go away. Whereas other systems, a good deal of our system for things like murder, where we require intent, and therefore in some sense we argue that the critical question is moral status. And this is a puzzle. Philosophers call this the puzzle of moral luck. One of the standard philosophers' version of this puzzle is, suppose you discover that your neighbor was a concentration camp guard in Nazi Germany. You're going to feel very badly about it. Now suppose somebody says to you, you know, I've done some research on the history of Nazi Germany. I've concluded that most people, if they were in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, offered a job as a concentration camp guard, would have taken it. Should we now say, well, I feel equally badly about all those other people who didn't happen to have the good luck not to be in that situation, but would have behaved in the same way if they had been? Right? That's the puzzle of moral luck. And I should say my very favorite discussion of this is in a book written in the 18th century by one of the most famous of economists, Adam Smith. Not his economics book, which is The Wealth of Nations, but his first famous book, which is The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And he devotes, I think, several chapters, as I remember, to the puzzle. And he offers a very nice explanation. He says that as a matter of proper morality, we ought to judge people by the inside of their heads. We ought to judge the person by what he intended to do, not by what happened. But we can't be trusted to do that, because we're all biased judges. And after all, if we judge people by the inside of their heads, all us good Englishmen know that all of those Catholics would murder the king if the Pope told them to. Because, right, I mean, for those of you who know Catholic-Protestant conflict in England in the 16th and 17th century. So since we know that, we ought to be able to hang all of the Catholics on the grounds that they would have committed a crime. They just didn't happen to have the opportunity, the incentive. And Smith says it is an evidence of divine benevolence that we've got this irrational prejudice in our head for only punishing people for things they did and not for things they would have done. Because God can punish people for things they would have done. God can see the state of your soul, but we can't be trusted to do it. So right, that's my favorite discussion. But there's a literature on moral luck, and if you're sufficiently curious. And it is indeed a puzzle that is worth thinking about, especially if you're going to be involved in the legal system as to which one we do it by. Let me give another, we're running out of time, but that's all right. Another interesting issue in legal systems is, do you use bright line rules or standards? Do you use the kind of rule where it's absolutely clear whether you did or didn't trespass it, which, for example, literal trespass usually is. There's a property boundary. Or do you use a rule such as you must drive at a reasonable speed? All right, a speed limit in theory, at least, is a bright line rule. Only in New Zealand do they actually enforce it as a bright line. If you're in New Zealand, don't speed. You'll go to jail, literally. At least that was the case when I was there. I did not go to jail, but I avoided it because I had been told about this peculiarity of New Zealand law. They actually take their law seriously. But in the U.S., all of us know that really up to about 10 miles over the speed limit, you're all right. And the advice I was given by a cop when I carelessly did faster than that was, as long as you're driving the same speed as everybody else, you're safe. Whether or not they're going over the speed limit. But in principle, some rules are bright line rules, some rules are standards which involve judgment. There are advantages and disadvantages to both, and how does the system decide? Final system issue, which is interesting for a number of the historical ones, maybe not the final one for today anyway, is how do you can't have a perfectly centralized system, because at least for any fairly large country, there's no way the emperor can look at every law case. All right? So at some level, there's some decentralization. How do you prevent decentralization from turning into feudalism? How do you prevent your local district magistrate, who is mayor, chief of police, et cetera, from building up a power base such that eventually he can defy the central government along with other people like him, and you no longer have an empire and you're back in the feuding states period of 500 BC or whatever it was before the Chinese Empire. And so that's an interesting puzzle which systems have solved in different ways. Any guesses how the Chinese solved that one? You're the Chinese emperor. How do you make sure that your magistrate doesn't become a feudal lord? You rotate them. You're not allowed to be district magistrate in one place for more than 3 years. That's one of the rules. Second rule, you're not allowed to marry anybody from the district you're magistrate in, because that's a way of making alliances, of course, marital alliances with the local power structure. So, and the Ottomans had a different interesting scheme, but I'll tell you about that some other time. Anyway, I think we're out of time. So think up your papers, do fun papers.